Despite the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, Utah's men's and women's professional soccer teams have found a way to keep the game going. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
In the world of professional sports, there has been very little you could call normal happening over the past few months. Worldwide cancellations and postponements across nearly all sports came one after the other in early March at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Professional soccer in Utah was no different. Major League Soccer suspended its season on March 12th, and the National Women's Soccer League followed suit soon after, delaying the start of their season on March 20th. There is some good news for soccer fans, however, as games have managed to return this summer. The NWSL was the first professional sports league in North America to return to play with the Challenge Cup in late June, held in the Salt Lake Valley. The MLS is also currently hosting a quarantined tournament of their own in Orlando, Florida. The Challenge Cup in Salt Lake features both Utah Royals FC and Real Monarchs and will run through the end of July. The tournament has even featured the first games with spectators. Fans were able to watch the games on July 11th with special restrictions in place at Rio Tinto Stadium. Andy Carroll is the chief business officer for Real Salt Lake and says every detail of a fan's experience has been carefully planned for the games with spectators. He says parking, socially distanced seating at the stadium, as well as dedicated bathrooms and concession areas for each section of the stadium have special protocols in place different from a traditional game experience.
You have to go through a different planning cycle and literally plan every detail of how you have ingress, and then you have the stadium experience, and then you have egress. So it's a very different model than what we've done in the past, where people just come to a stadium and and if you've done it before, then you know it, and if you haven't done it before, you kind of figure it out and look at the signs. We can't have people figuring it out.
Carroll says RSL has only allowed just over 5,000 spectators per game at Rio Tinto. He adds the club's early planning for spectator-friendly games bodes well in the event the MLS resumes regular play at stadiums across the country in the near future.
If and when Real Salt Lake comes back, that we will have a huge advantage relative to other clubs because we've done it.
Carroll says even though RSL has been hard at work for a safe return to regular league play, a lot of that decision-making is out of their control. All of the teams spread across the United States and Canada need to meet the same health standards in order for play to continue outside of the bubble in Orlando. He says a lot of moving pieces must come together in a constantly changing environment.
We also share stadiums. So if you think of NYCFC, for example, in New York plays the Yankee Stadium, and the Seattle Sounders play where the Seahawks play. And so the flexibility in stadiums is even difficult. So that we don't have that, and there's a lot of other clubs that don't as well. It's a challenge.
The semifinals of the Challenge Cup at Rio Tinto Stadium take place on Wednesday, July 22nd, with the finals on Sunday, July 26th. Fans will not be allowed at these games, but they can catch the action on CBS and CBS All Access. The men's tournament in Orlando concludes on August 11th. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
It's KPCW 8:15 news time. Park City School District Superintendent Jill Gilday and Chief Operating Officer Mike Tanner are on two lines here to talk to us about the district back-to-school plan. Welcome. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Yeah, so the governor announced recently a mask mandate for students and teachers when schools reopen on August 20th. For us, it's August 20th here in Park City. School boards across the state have been working these past weeks to provide a plan to the State Board of Education, which is due August 1st. And that plan is supposed to be a roadmap, basically, of how schools can open doors and bring students back to the classroom. So let's start off by kind of talking about just what that will look like in August when kids start making their way back into the classroom.
Right. So we do have a ready to return to school plan in Park City School District, just like all of the districts across the state and really across the nation are building those roadmaps. And those are obviously informed by everything from the CDC to our state health department to our local health department's guidelines. So there will be many things that will be the same. You know, you're going to see welcoming, you know, decorations in our classrooms, and you're going to see teachers who are very enthusiastic to get back to the business of education. But we're going to have some different procedures that we teach the students about and we teach the families about, starting right now all the way up until the time school starts. So things like, you know, washing our hands often and wearing a cloth face covering when we are with our friends and when we're in our schools and classrooms, and staying farther apart from one another so that in case we have to sneeze or cough, we are not, you know, exposing the environment to those germs. And we're going to see a frequent cleaning of frequently touched objects. You're going to see a lot more hard surface, frequently touched surfaces, have a lot more attention, encouraging kids and adults. And we all have this habit more than we realize of touching our eyes, nose, and mouth, you know, frequently. So try to teach people to keep our hands away from our faces, you know, good tissue hygiene, and then really hammering home, you know, staying home if we're sick.
Right.
Those are going to be really important features.
Right. And when you're talking about this age range of children from, you know, pre-K to seniors in high school, it's an interesting thing because the little ones, they probably aren't expelling as much because their bodies are small. The big kids are like adults who are expelling the, you know, whatever slobber is what I call it, but they expel it from their mouth and their nose, and they probably have kind of similar hygiene practices. So how will that happen?
Right. Well, just like our positive behavior support systems that we have in school, which basically means we teach the expectations and we teach the rationale. So what will happen is when teachers return, they will start learning all of the OSHA-aligned guidelines, you know, all of these strategies that will keep us safe as an essential service to our community. And then as soon as our teachers master this, obviously, then they're able to have lessons ready, have visual prompts in the classroom and near faucets and fountains, and be able to, in the beginning of the year, you know, just establish these as some of the new routines and procedures that we need to do to keep one another healthy and safe.
Sure. And you received a lot of very good questions last night in the school board meeting from parents wondering how it will all work. And can you talk a little bit, Jill, about the virtual and in-person learning options that are going to be offered?
Yes. So as of tomorrow, Thursday the 23rd, what will start happening is everybody who has registered is already enrolled in our schools, and they're enrolled as in-person students. However, on the 23rd, we will send out a message that says, you know, you've registered, you've pre-enrolled. However, you know, if you are interested in the remote learning option instead of returning to traditional Monday through Friday schedule, please check the box here and submit. Or I have questions and I really need to hear from my principal or counselor, and check there. So that way we will have, we'll start gathering those counts for how many families are interested in remote learning, how many are interested in returning to in-person learning, so that we can then develop our educators' calendar and schedules from there. So it's a tight timeline, but we feel that this choice is very important. The remote learning option, so the learning at home, will follow a daily schedule. There will be, you know, ways that the students interact with the adults, with the teachers, as well as being able to self-direct some of their learning. So what parents will have available to them in that email that they receive is a few links that describe more about the remote learning opportunity, as well as what remote learning is and what remote learning is not, so that we can, you know, clarify some of those situations. Because remote learning is not sitting in front of the screen for 7 hours a day, because that's not what happens in a regular classroom either. You have a little bit of instruction, you go and you do some practice, you check in with a partner, and we can model that sort of structure online as well. The remote option will follow our Park City School District curriculum, you know, all of the standards, and it is the same curriculum that's happening in the classroom. So that way, after one quarter, you know, if the health conditions change and families would rather return their child to in-person, they will not have missed a beat. So in our district, we are making elections each marking term rather than for the full year like some of our surrounding area districts. So we have a little bit more flexibility.
Okay. When you say term, you mean the quarter?
A grading term.
Grading term.
So
okay.
In our elementary schools, our grading term is a trimester long. And in our secondary schools, it is a quarter by quarter.
Okay. And as far as the impact that this will have on the educators in the district, how will they be managing both the virtual platform and the in-person platform?
So educators will be assigned to being either an in-person instructional educator or an online instructional educator. So people will have different job assignments in the system. That's for elementary. For secondary teachers, they may have two sections of their courses face-to-face, and then they may parallel that with their other two sections online. So their other two, their online section would be at the same time that their in-person would have been if the kids were all returning to school. So basically their schedule will remain. They just may have some classes that are in-person face-to-face and other times where they're in their classroom without a student in front of them other than virtually. But that way the kids will have a synchronous schedule that they can follow so that they know they have access to their teacher from, you know, 9 until 10:50 or whatever the classroom block period is. So we, you know, mirroring that for kids, having a schedule, we think will be a big improvement and a big help for them in the remote environment.
Okay. And then let's maybe switch over and talk a little bit with Mike about just some of the, for the students who are going into the classroom and into the school facilities, what sorts of measures are in place from an operational standpoint to address just transmission of the virus and keeping it clean? And,
you know, it's really a lesson in risk management. And the virus, as we know, can transmit through a number of different methods. And so we have identified those along with the CDC guidelines and Utah State Board of Education guidelines to kind of methodically go through that risk spectrum and knock them out as best that we can. So we're going to do all of the recommended things that everyone's heard about, the face coverings in the school, social distancing, directional movement within the hallways, like you'll see throughout any of the stores here in town. And we've done some other really neat things that we've attacked our air circulation system as one of our components of this risk management strategy, and inserted advanced filters and ionizers, and we're also increasing the amount of fresh air brought into the schools. And then our sanitation procedures, we've added an extra custodian per building that's going to do nothing but wipe down touch surfaces, clean restrooms, and help with lunch cleanup that ends up being in some of the classrooms. But we've also examined the cleaning regimen that we use for fogging rooms and cleaning rooms and touch surfaces, and got the appropriate EPA blessed, FDA blessed, human-friendly cleaning agents that are best for our schools. So those are in place too.
Sure. One of the questions that had come through was, around the sensitivity that some people may have to really strong cleaning supplies. But you had responded that the products are hydrogen peroxide based. Is that correct?
That's right. Our two main cleaning agents that we're going to use to both fog the rooms and to clean our touch surfaces are all hydrogen peroxide based. And we'll have those material safety data sheets available for families to use and post it up on our website.
Okay. Well, so what about buses? How does that? How will that work? And maybe also talk about spacing in classrooms. Will desks be rearranged and assigned seats and that type of thing?
You know, all of the above. Let's start with the transportation piece first. You know, transportation, you're in an environment where a lot of children are packed on a bus in some cases. In some of our routes, we have very few kids on the bus. So we're going to first take a look at how many children are going to arrive for actually in-person instruction and build our routes around that. Right now, the CDC and the state are recommending a 6-foot separation between children. But if they have face coverings on, we can reduce that spacing somewhat. Our goal is going to be to have no more than 2 children on the seat, unless they're a family unit. And we're going to load the buses from the back to the front, as they are with the airlines now, to reduce children from walking past others and potentially breathing into them. All of our buses are going to be clean when the kids show up in the morning. We'll clean them before the afternoon route starts, after the morning route is done, and then we'll clean them again in the evenings. We'll have hand sanitizer dispensers on all the buses for the kids, and our drivers will have extra masks in case our kids show up without a face covering. Our drivers obviously are a big concern here too, and they're going to ensure that the kids are in assigned seats. That will help us in the event that we have to do contact tracing to pin down the source of a contaminant. And the drivers will also wear heavier N95 masks that will increase the amount of filtration that they have. Back to the classrooms, if we talk about spacing there, you know, our standard classroom is about 900 square feet. And if you do the math with an instructor's seat and about 24 kids, we can get 6 feet between all of our desks. We are anticipating some reduction in the number of students who actually show up for in-person instruction, so that'll probably help us with those classroom densities. But we're also prepared to use some of our larger common spaces in the event that we do have a classroom that exceeds that 6-foot capability. We also will have, on a limited basis, in some rooms, especially for some of our younger ones, some desktop plexiglass shields that'll help us provide a second layer of protection between our kids and each other.
Okay. Wow. It's going to be an interesting start of school this year. So tell me, Jill or Mike, do you have any sense of how many people will be interested in virtual school versus, you know, coming to school and being physically there?
Well, we do know from a survey that we conducted right at the end of the school year that 65 to 70% of our families and our staff are ready to return. And we probably will have that, you know, 20 to 25, maybe up to 30% who elect to do our remote model. So the good news is we have some flexibility to be able to do that. The other good news is that we have multiple scenarios from our return to school task forces where, depending on the environment and the conditions, we could, you know, pivot as a district to fully remote very quickly. We could pivot to some different hybrid solutions pretty quickly. So we feel like we are in good shape to be able to meet the needs of the community and keep our students and our staff healthy.
Yeah, and I recall last night, I guess maybe it was President Kaplan said something to the effect of more than 100 people have been involved in creating this roadmap.
That is correct. We have a really wonderfully engaged community and group of educators and staff who volunteered their time among their work requirements because we were still in school as we were building all of these, and then we've just been fine-tuning them since, you know, school was out. But people, you know, really came together and shared insights and ideas and creative, you know, the creativity, innovation, you know, all of that came through. And then, of course, we, you know, layer on, you know, what are the actual CDC guidelines? What are the Utah School Nurses Association team saying? You know, what is the State Department of Health saying? And layer all of that together. And we feel we have come up with not only some simple infographics to be able to give people a quick at a glance, what are we doing, but then also the depth of having these implementation plans ready.
Sure. Well, it sounds to me like there's really no rest for those of you in the school district this summer. You've got a lot of work to do.
We are absolutely calling it the year of no summer break.
There's no summer break here. Yeah. Well, I appreciate both of you coming on this morning. I feel like we could go on for a very long time talking about these really important issues that we're facing. And of course, it's dominating the national headlines right now, back to school. So hopefully we can have you back to talk more about this as we get closer to school opening.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That is Park City School District Superintendent Dr. Jill Gilday and Chief Operating Officer Mike Tanner. It's 8:32, and our next guest is Historic Park City Alliance Executive Director Allison Kulo. She is on the phone to give us an update on the car-free Sunday experiment on Park City's historic Main Street. Thank you for joining us this morning, Allison. Thank you for joining us, Allison.
Happy to be here.
So let's start off. There was a board meeting yesterday to discuss just, I guess, the effectiveness of this car-free Sunday. I'm calling it an experiment, but there was some discussion also of maybe expanding it to include Saturdays. Can you talk a little bit about what you heard from your board?
I can. We did have a board meeting yesterday, and at that meeting, we were able to share survey results from our merchants. And we had asked the merchants over the last few days three different questions. The first being, are they seeing increased sales on Sundays because of the car-free environment? The second, do they want the car-free Sundays to extend past September 6th, which is the last date that City Council had approved them for? And then finally, was there an interest from the merchants to have car-free Saturdays? So those were the three items that the board discussed. And again, we had a survey from the membership so that they had just some more input when they made that decision yesterday.
And what did they decide?
Aha. So they decided that they would like the car-free Sundays to expand past September 6th through the fall. And we don't have an end date in the fall. Right now we're just saying September and October. But what we're finding is that it is almost 50-50 as far as those that can attribute a higher sales or a greater sales due to the car-free environment and those that are actually suffering from it. So as far as moving forward, everyone was supportive of it because it is helping some. With regards to the Saturdays really came up in discussion because of the bars. The bars have such limited seating capacity, and the temporary DABC licensing regulations don't allow them to cross the sidewalk, so they can't operate a dining deck. They can't cross the sidewalk with alcohol if they're a tavern or bar. And so you've been seeing their expanded footprint on Sundays, and that's really what spurred on the discussion. But many felt that if we had car-free Saturdays, it wouldn't make Sundays feel as special, as well as there are some that are not having good days because of the Sundays. So the board decided not to do car-free Saturdays. However, they're looking at 3 to 4 options to just have them maybe on typical festival weekends. So we may be looking at asking for a car-free Saturday on the Saturday of Arts Fest.
Okay. The Saturday of Arts Festival? You mean the first weekend in August?
August, yes.
Oh, okay. So the DABC never came through with allowing that exception, I guess. Is that?
Not for the bars and taverns to cross the sidewalk, correct?
But restaurants can.
Correct.
Oh, I see. Okay. So what have they been telling you about sales? What's the general feeling?
Yeah, so the general feeling is, you know, people like the car-free Sundays, but that it's more people that are up to stroll versus shop. But it does provide a nice atmosphere, and for those who aren't, you know, or who would prefer more social distancing space, people are drawn to the area. But we're seeing kind of a mix. Those that have outdoor dining or outdoor components are doing well on Sundays, it appears. But there are others, such as retailers and galleries, that aren't doing as well. And so when the board makes decisions, they always look at the whole of the street and all of the industries represented.
Sure. So, I mean, anecdotally, we hear that things are very busy. The trails, of course, are packed with people who do not live here full time. There are sports, you know, businesses, sports retailers around town that just can't even keep a bike in, that type of thing, or hiking shoes or hiking poles. So is that's not really rolling into the commercial opportunities on Main Street? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, not necessarily in the way that we would assume. And I think, you know, one of the things to look at is how long people are staying. You know, when we turn over guests week over week, we have a new fresh bunch of tourists coming to Main Street. If we now see people staying for 3 weeks, we're not getting that fresh group every week. And so, you know, sales do look different when patterns change. And, you know, while we're hearing from businesses that they're pleasantly surprised, or some are pleasantly surprised by the numbers, people are not seeing numbers that are over 2019. A few have been able to match, but no one's, you know, breaking new ground this year. And a lot are between 40 to 55% down.
Oh, I see. So what was the sentiment is that overall they like Sundays car-free enough to extend it into, what, the end of October? Is that what you're planning?
As long as weather would provide.
Okay. And then there was also some discussion about opening the street at 5 p.m. on Sundays to traffic again. Where did that come out?
So where we're on that is we're going to actually take a survey. At this point, the board was willing to explore with the merchants if they feel that it's a benefit on Sundays to have it remain closed after 5. That wasn't something included within the survey that we sent previously. And so not only will we be sending that question out today, but we'll also be sending out the proposed 3 to 4 Saturdays for the next few months. So still getting in merchants' input, so those aren't set in stone, but that's where we're aiming right now to see how everyone feels.
Oh, okay. So it could be, you know, sporadically through the rest of the season into the fall that maybe Saturdays would also be closed to cars, depending on how they respond. Okay. And then what are merchants saying about the mask mandate? Do they still need to be enforced? Are people finding cooperative, customers and that type of thing?
Right. So within the last 2 weeks, I definitely have felt that it's settled down a bit as far as the merchants having discussions with those who don't have masks. The biggest piece is for the merchants to have extra masks on hand. And we talked a little bit about that before the meeting started. There have been some restaurants that had to turn away customers because they didn't have masks. And so the more that we can kind of keep those supplies coming, I know there was some free opportunities, as well as there's now a state grant for PPE and employees. The more we can make that available, the better it's going to be.
And is that something that you're doing for your members, or are they independently finding their own access to those grants?
They're independently finding their own access to the grants because it is individual per business, and it talks a lot about how many employees you have and a per employee type stipend. But for my role, it's to make sure that the merchants know what's available. And as well, the city had source some, as well as Summit County, some free masks that the merchants helped distribute to the other businesses.
Okay. And also the HPCA has commented in an article in the Park Record that they were taken by surprise by the art murals on Main Street. And it's been such an interesting and elevated conversation, the Black Lives Matter murals. Can you talk about what the HPCA was thinking and how they feel about this?
I think, you know, what I'm able to say is it is correct. We didn't know about the murals until the paint went down and until people understood that it was paint, not chalk. That's when we started asking what was going on. So we did not have a heads up. There were a lot of things we felt like we could have assisted with had we been spoken to beforehand, whether it was just given a heads up or whether asked permission. You know, a lot of the merchants didn't well, everyone didn't know this was coming. So, you know, if we could have had talking points for the merchants and the employees about what was going on and what this message was meaning, if we could have worked with, you know, not having it take from curb to curb, because what it ended up doing is narrowing the walkway for people, which was the whole point of having the street shut. We could have worked through that. So, you know, at this point for us, it's not about the message, it's about the process.
Okay. And just to circle back to the financial impacts of what's happening on Main Street, do you have numbers yet? Have you started to look at what the revenues are in terms of, you know, the tax impacts and that type of thing for, you know, this period of time? I know we're always operating maybe 30 to 60 days out, but do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, so it is a 60-day out piece, and I did have a meeting earlier this week. We're pulling together an economic forecast to kind of help the businesses understand what they may face this winter. You know, the more perspective that businesses have as far as different scenarios, the better they can plan. We will be going out and doing a survey of the merchants asking a month-over-month change from 2019 to 2020, and that will come out in the next few weeks. Sales tax numbers, we won't be able to have sales tax numbers for June until September. And so, you know, I see this information being updated as we go, but our goal is to have something available the beginning of September that really does do an analysis of what we've seen and then what we're looking at.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Allison Kulo, Historic Park City Alliance Executive Director, giving us an update on the Sunday experiment, the car-free Sunday experiment. Thanks.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Well, Summit County Council voted to begin enforcing stricter parking policies at popular trailheads just last week. Signage was put in place over this past weekend, and enforcement is scheduled to begin on August 1st. KPCW's Sean Higgins has details.
Overcrowding at Summit County trailheads and congestion on the trails has become a serious problem in recent years. Parking overflow into residential areas and etiquette issues have led to friction with nearby residents. Now, as a solution, Summit County Council will enforce stricter policies in order to relieve some of the tensions. Signs were put in place over the weekend at the popular Robbs Trail and Summit Park trailheads. They notify trail users they cannot park on the street outside of the designated trailhead parking areas. Basin Recreation Trails Manager Matt Wagoner says a strict enforcement period will begin on August 1st.
We're going to work with the Summit County Public Works Department to get the no parking signs put in within the next couple of weeks, and then starting August 1st is when what we're considering sort of our beginning of the enforcement period, and that will be an escalating enforcement where you're ticketed, then you're booted, then you're towed, and then after a month of that, starting in September, then it's just, if you're outside of the designated parking areas, then the tow truck is just going to be called.
Wagoner says other remedies like a paid parking program are not ideal solutions to the problem because of the costs associated with enforcement. He says their research on the subject led them to conclude it would cost more to enforce the policies than what they would make in paid parking. In fact, Wagoner says the program would likely require more people to visit the trails and pay for parking in order to be a financially viable solution. Wagoner adds initial enforcement of the parking policies will be by the Summit County Sheriff's Office until Basin Rec is granted jurisdiction over the parking areas.
We have to be empowered with the ability to enforce those county codes, and that's a process that's happening now. County Council should, I think, by the end of this month, be hearing some recommendations about how to modify the county's administrative code to allow us to do that. So in the short term, we're relying on the Sheriff's Department, and they have very generously agreed to patrol some of these areas more often.
More information about the trail policy can be found on the Basin Recreation website, and weekly Summit County Council meetings are held on Wednesdays. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
And I've got Aaron Ferguson on the line with Save People, Save Wildlife, the organization based here in Summit County. The group has announced they are getting a little closer to making wildlife and humans safer while crossing and driving on I-80 near Kimball Junction. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So it's been a little while since you've been on. We had a real flurry of wildlife stories going on this past winter and spring with things happening out on 224 and some of the hot spots that were identified in a study that was done. Give us an update on just the progress of wildlife fencing and other measures that you're working on in this area.
Okay, well, we'll start with 224 because I know that was, pinpointed last December in Dr. Kramer's report via UDOT. And so DWR and UDOT are working together and continuing with, the last we met with them was February of this year. And they said that they were in the midst of getting studies funded to further understand the area and the migration patterns of the wildlife there. So that being said, it's kind of a pending project. So as a result, while they're doing that on 224, we're all focusing on finishing the wildlife fencing along I-80 because we're close. We just have to go just past Silver Creek Junction to meet the wildlife fencing that comes out of Wanship Canyon. So the frustrating thing where we're at right now is that, in these pandemic times, it's not really viewed as a priority. However, you're not going to make a car and put it out on the road to drive with only three wheels. And that's what's happening right now. So the wildlife fencing is not complete. And so you're still seeing wildlife, even with existing fencing, you're still seeing wildlife hit on the roads and motorists are at risk. So we're kind of in a frustrating position as far as how do we make this a priority to people? How do we convince the entities and the powers that be that the funding needs to go to this fencing and the cattle guards and potentially more wildlife overpasses and underpasses to make this puzzle complete? Because if we continue at this rate, we're doing a mile at a time, which equates to a half mile on each side of the interstate. It's going to be 20 years at this rate before we see that fencing complete to Silver Creek just past Silver Creek Junction. So that's where we're at right now. But, the successes are the wildlife bridge is working. The wildlife fencing is working. The animals that are walking the fencing to where it ends and crossing the freeway, that's our Achilles heel right now.
So how many more miles of fencing are you trying to get finished up here?
Well, we were doing, immediate goals, right? Jeremy to Kimball to Silver Creek Junction. So if we can get, we're concerned about that area by the High Ute Ranch, still has right-of-way fencing. The wildlife fencing ends just right there, and we have seen multiple wildlife deaths over the past, winters, especially in springs, that, they cross to go from the Rasmussen side to the Kilby side and via that High Ute Ranch corridor. Also, the Swana Preserve is just east of Kimball, huge migration pattern there crossing I-80 back and forth. So we're concerned that we need to complete this fencing along I-80. And then hopefully by the time we get that finished, then the studies will be complete on 224 and we can address that area appropriately as well.
And how much have you raised so far for the fences that you've successfully put in?
Well, it's a collaborative effort. So we've raised almost, probably a little over $100,000 thanks to our generous donors and community support. We couldn't do it without you. And that's the issue also is that, there are a handful of people that know that Save People, Save Wildlife is responsible with the help of the community to back this effort. But the majority of people, just talking, on social media and face-to-face, they think it's a UDOT project. And so we need to realize that UDOT would not be doing this on their own if they didn't have community and, petitions being signed, community, outreach and demand that something be done. So a big thank you to our community and our generous donors.
Sure. The wildlife bridge that was installed a couple of years ago over Parley Summit has been a collaborative effort because there was a co-effort on the part of the community and the projects that were being done on the highway. So they
correct,
kind of
and so that UDOT
in.
Qualified for federal grant money for that project, so they were able to do. Apparently, the mandatory noise wall was required as part of that project, but with that funding, they were able to do the climbing lane, the sound wall, the wildlife overpass, so and complete that fencing on each side of the freeway.
So
in that area, so UDOT does not have any road projects planned, so they're not putting wildlife fencing on the docket because it's not, you know, they like to do multiple things in one area at one time, which makes sense in terms of efficiency, but we need to have the wildlife fencing done to make the roadways safer. Yeah.
And just getting back to the bridge and its effectiveness, I know when it first went in, there was kind of a general consensus on the part of the experts that wildlife probably would take a couple, 3 years to really utilize that bridge, to really understand where it is, to teach other generations, you know, that this is how you cross. But it really turned out quite differently, didn't it?
It did, and it's a pretty it speaks well to the fact of how much corridors are needed in this area, right? We had the advantage of, in 2011, the wildlife fencing in Parley's Canyon, you know, just west of Summit, you know, Parley Summit, was completed. So the wildlife already had an idea of, we have to walk some fencing to get across. But then it ended right at Parley Summit, where the county line is. So putting the bridge in, it may not be the best location for a wildlife overpass, but the wildlife had a few years of experience walking the fence line and say, oh, hey, now we have an option right here. So I think, you know, in, you know, time will tell, you know, it was, you know, a few years of studies and skepticism and money and people weren't sure. And so I said, well, you know, let's just put it in. And UDOT has claimed that it is kind of an experimental situation, you know, and it turned out extremely well. So, yes.
Okay. So how much, Aaron, are you looking to raise?
Well, to complete this next mile, we need another $9,000. And we've made arrangements with UDOT to be payable by November 30th of this year, which will allow for Live PC, Give PC fundraising efforts and the months before then. So hopefully we can meet that goal. Yeah.
So $9,000 is what you need. And how can...
Yes, for this next mile. But, in recent discussions, an upfront donation to pay for the completion of the wildlife fencing and cattle guards where on and off ramps are would be the most beneficial and would see the most positive effects right away. Mm-hmm. And then we can maintain the fencing, you know, put our efforts towards maintaining that fencing in the years to come rather than piecemealing a half mile at a time on each side of the freeway for the next 20 years.
Yeah. So November 30th, is that sort of a drop-dead date for UDOT? Will they back off of the project if you don't raise that money?
I'm not clear on that. I can't speak for them. But we did make efforts. I know they set up the contractor to do the work, you know, while they had time in their schedule last spring. So they said, you know, we just want to be ahead of the game on this. And so we said, okay, so it's going to take us a few months to finish raising the funds that we need. And so as a compromise, we decided on November 30th. But I'm confident that we can meet that $9,000 goal by then, especially with Live BC, Give BC the first part of November.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Well, I just want to, first of all, extend a very, very heartfelt thank you from all of us at Save People, Save Wildlife. We couldn't do this without generous donors in our community supporting us. And then also, if there's anyone with big, deep pockets out there that is willing to fund the remaining cost for the wildlife fencing to be completed in the near future, that would be, it would pay for itself in the next 2-3 years. So,
yeah. Okay.
And the safety of wildlife and motorists would be increased dramatically. So. Yeah.
Okay. That's Aaron Ferguson with the Save People, Save Wildlife organization. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for your time. Have a great day.
You too. It's 8:58. Well, just a reminder, with Pioneer Day weekend just days away, Park City Municipal has announced a fireworks ban within the city limits, and Rick Bruff has more on this.
The city announced the immediate prohibition on fireworks and open source flames on Tuesday afternoon. Dave Thacker, who is chief building official and fire code official for the city, said they came to the decision based on environmental conditions in the area in conjunction with the county's fire warden, Bryce Boyer, Park City Fire Marshal Mike Owens, Police Chief Wade Carpenter, and Emergency Manager Mike McComb. The city did not announce a ban during the July 4th holiday, but Thacker said they've seen a change in precipitation in the past few weeks.
We've seen higher temperatures, and we've seen a lot more wind, which does create that drier condition. We've also been able to see from surrounding areas, you know, a lot of fires being started from fireworks and from other means that are man-made. There are not a lot of lightning starts this year. It's fireworks, it's firearms, it's things that may spark fire. Some are cigarette butts that haven't been put out completely. And so with those drier conditions and learning from what our neighboring communities have had to go through, we feel it's an important step to take. During the July 4th holiday, we had still a lot of moisture in the grasses and the trees in the woods in the area that were keeping conditions still in a safe zone, if you will, to allow those open flames and fireworks to take place.
Thacker said the ban is in place indefinitely.
What we'll continue to do is monitor those environmental conditions, and we'll look at a reasonable time to rescind that ban. Typically and historically, we've lifted that ban mid to late October. It will all be dependent upon weather patterns, basically, and how wet our fall is or the latter part of the summer.
Park City Fire Code official Dave Thacker. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
It's 9:01. This has been the Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray, sitting in for Leslie Thacher. You have been listening to KPCW Park City. Here's NPR News.